Hello and welcome to Leading at a Local Level, which is an MLG podcast talking about issues related to leadership in local churches, local organisations and local businesses. And so, John, it's great to have you with us again. How are you doing, John?
Yeah, really well. Thanks, Tim. Great to be here again. Really excited about this series that we're in. So, yeah, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you, John. Yeah, I'm good. We are recording this in the summer. So, of course, we said we would try not to, date these, but it is quite warm at the moment. So we're all kind of slightly sweaty, aren't we, John?
Yep.
Let's talk about it.
Along the side, you're doing that kind of, you know, reducing the glare off my forehead. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. So we're in the middle of a series on leading diversity. And one of the things that's just so obvious in our churches at the moment is just really the recognition that we are increasingly diverse churches, and we've got all different types of people, different perspectives, different backgrounds coming into our church. And part of being a good leader, whether you're leading in church or you're leading in a charity or you're leading in a business, is learning how to appreciate people who are not the same as us and to lead them well. And so today we're going to be talking about leading those that would identify as same-sex attracted, aren't we, John? Which is a really interesting subject.
It is. Yeah. And I think that's the question for us today is, as leaders, as those who are thinking about our churches in that way, what does it look like to be a church that welcomes people who are same-sex attracted? And there are lots of people who are same-sex attracted who I've spoken to have found that church hasn't felt like a home for them. They haven't actually felt welcomed. Perhaps it's because of a big focus on families, on nuclear families. Perhaps there's, even at the other end of the extreme spectrum, there's even a culture of homophobia. Perhaps there's been stereotypes reinforced. You know, this is what real men do, and this is what real women do or don't do, and so on. And so yeah, that's our question today, is how can local churches be places where people are welcome? So this is a big topic. It means touching on singleness, which we're dealing with obviously in one of our other episodes, but marriage, identity, gay conversion therapy. So just a small topic for us to deal with today. And therefore, I'm delighted it's not just you and I speaking about it, and that we are going to be joined by Andrew Bunt, who is part of a church on the Southeast Coast. He is Emerging Generations Director at Living Out, which is a fantastic organization helping people, churches and society talk about faith and sexuality. And he's written a small book last year, People Not Pronouns, looking at the transgender experience. And he speaks widely and writes widely on these issues. And so I think Andrew is waiting in our green room. It'd be great to bring Andrew in. Andrew, welcome to the podcast. Great to see you today.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
Fantastic. And just before we came on, we were all set up to go and you got window cleaners. So how is that going? Is your window been cleaned yet?
Literally in front of me right now, just here, the window cleaner is cleaning my window. Yeah, so you may or may not be able to hear that. I don't know.
Oh, fantastic. Now, you live a bit too far, because I need my windows clean. I can hardly see out of my window because it's a fairly new, haven't had it cleaned yet. So, but you are too far away from me to do that. Tell us a bit about where you live, Andrew.
So I'm in Bexhill, southeast coast, a kind of a small seaside town in between the bigger towns of Hastings and Eastbourne, which many people know. People can ask what's Bexhill like. The way I tend to put it in context with people is there's a saying which is half a joke and to be honest half true, that people move to Hastings and Eastbourne to retire and then to Bexhill to die. And so it is kind of the epitome of Southeast retirementville. And so I'm a slight anomaly, to be honest, but it's a lovely, quiet, sunny seaside place to live, so I don't mind that.
Yeah, great. So, but I understand, Andrew, that you don't stay in Bexhill all the time. Tell us a bit about what your work, what life looks like for you day to day, week by week.
Yeah, no, sometimes I question whether I actually live in Bexhill, and so I think the people around me do. I spend a lot of my life travelling the country doing different things. So my kind of working life and ministry life is split between a few things. I'm Emerging Generations Director at Living Out. So I have a particular responsibility for how do we help or how do we engage with under 25s and those working with them with a kind of Christian perspective on sexuality. That involves quite a lot of travelling. We run quite a lot of events, you know, a lot of youth festivals over the summer, different things like that. I'm also part of a team who runs some training stuff in part of New Frontiers and Newground, one of the families within New Frontiers. That involves some traveling mostly to London. And I have a couple of days in my week where I do broader itinerant ministry, a lot of speaking and writing. That also involves quite a lot of traveling. So I do spend a lot of my life on trains and motorways. And being home is always quite a joy because of that.
Yeah, Yeah, no, fantastic. Thanks. So Andrew, you're obviously really experienced in speaking to church leaders and those in, you know, with responsibilities in the local church. And that's what we're really all about on this podcast. But it's not just that you've got some expertise in this area, but actually this has been a real life issue for you. And so it'd be great just to hear a bit about your story. Just tell us a bit about your story from, you know, when you were younger and why you're here, I guess, today talking to us about this topic about real people.
Yeah. So I grew up just on the coast in Hastings in the church that I'm still a part of, went away for uni stuff, but I've come back. I became a Christian at quite a young age. I think like a lot of children who grew up in a church, kind of there are a few points I can remember in my life when I gave my life to Jesus. I guess if you grow up and know more of yourself as a kid, you give more of yourself to him. And so I think I first made a decision to follow Jesus about age 5 or something. But I have a very distinct memory as well, age 9, at being at Stoneleigh, which was a big kind of family Bible camp at the time, and becoming a Christian then. And I kind of remember at that point in my life, looking down the timeline of how I thought life would go. And I thought that it was very obvious that I would get to my early 20s, I would get married, I would settle down with a decent job and have a few children. And that would be kind of what life would be. Because I kind of looked around me, that's what everyone seemed to do in the church around me. That's what kind of seemed to be at least implied, if not stated, was the right thing to do, kind of from the pulpit and such like. I just thought, obviously, I'm a good Christian, that's what's going to happen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I reached my early teen years and I began to realize that I'm same-sex attracted. So as my romantic and sexual desires emerged, they were consistently for guys, not for girls. And I think, to be honest, when that first happened, I actually generally didn't realize what was going on in a sense. I had a pretty sheltered Christian upbringing. This is now just under 20 years ago. The world was a very different place at that point. And I don't think I really knew that some people are same-sex attracted or gay. And so I kind of didn't know what to do with it. I didn't tell anyone, though. I guess I was sufficiently unsure or uncomfortable with it that I just didn't tell anyone. I just kind of plodded on for a few years until I got to the middle of my teenage years, when I guess by that point I was more aware of what I was experiencing, kind of the fact this was an experience some people have. And one day shared with a guy who was kind of mentoring me. Even that was kind of a funny thing. It wasn't particularly planned. It was quite a surprise to him and I think to me. He just kind of said one day, is there anything else you want to talk about or tell me? And to my surprise, I kind of took that opportunity. And I remember it was that point, must have been 14 or 15, it was that point that it suddenly became for me this realization of, oh, hang on a minute, I'm attracted to guys, but I want to faithfully follow Jesus. How do these two things go together? And it was almost like telling someone, I guess, had made it very much more real for me. As that really started that journey of, okay, what does this mean? How do I kind of square this circle? How do I hold these two things together? And really, as the years went on, I kind of then processed that in two stages. And I'm so grateful I can kind of look back and see the hand of God of how he prepared things, took me through a journey to be able to wrestle with that and get to a place of thinking, no, okay, this is, I think, how I can faithfully follow Jesus in that. And so the first stage was wrestling with, well, what does God actually think about this? What does Christian faithfulness look like? What does the Bible say? Which is a question I was already beginning to wrestle with, but then kind of was forced into a situation where I really had to. So my A-level RS studies, a whole half of our A-level was an in-depth study of Christianity and homosexuality. And I found myself in this class, I was the only boy, there are I think 12 girls, only one of whom was a Christian, I'm not sure what her viewing it was, and the teacher was a really lovely guy who was going to go into the Catholic priesthood, but he was gay and didn't feel he could live out the church's teaching, and so he became a teacher. So I found myself as the closeted gay guy, evangelical Christian, in this classroom, having to wrestle with what should I believe and then kind of defend that to this class, which was a kind of intense situation to be in, but was really helpful because it kind of forced me to wrestle with what does the Bible say? Why is it this? Do I believe this? And it kind of actually gave me a really firm footing in not, I believe what I've been taught. I believe what the church has believed for 2,000 years, that sex and marriage are reserved for relationships of one man and one woman united in marriage for life. So that was kind of really helpful. And I think at that point, I was 17, I guess. I am quite a pragmatic person. And I think I was just like, oh, okay, so I'll be single. That'll be fine. I think I was just kind of a little bit naive and young and thought, that's fine. So I kind of went off to uni and stuff. And I guess in my early 20s was really the second stage of the journey, just of realizing actually that's not quite as simple and easy, as comfortable as I thought it would be. And beginning to realize so many of my friends were getting partners, already getting married because my church was a few years older than me. And just beginning to realize actually this whole thing of being an adult who's single, this feels much more difficult than I thought it would be. But actually in that season, God just was so good to me in bringing along really good friends. And particularly actually for me, it was families who took me in. One family kind of were parents of my parents' age and they had kids my age. One were people my age with kids, with young kids. And just began to experience actually the fact that I could experience love, I could experience family, and that singleness didn't have to mean loneliness, isolation, a lack of intimacy, all that kind of stuff. So it was like actually this thing which had begun to feel quite implausible, can I actually do this, can this actually work, became plausible. Actually, there are ways that God can provide for the kind of legitimate needs that he's given me. And that we all have as humans. And so really my journey, or the key part of my journey, I feel is those two steps of wrestling with what God said, but then he helped me realize in a sense, how do you live out? And then a decade later, just under a decade, you know, life's not always easy and straightforward, as it isn't for any of us. But those two things are the foundations really on which I'm seeking to faithfully live this out as a follower of Jesus.
Mm. Wow. Oh, thanks, Andrew. Yeah, it's really, really great to hear. Thank you for sharing that. I wondered if you just give us a feel as to, in terms of numbers across the UK, I don't know if you've got these off the top of your head, but what sort of numbers, because the of people who are same-sex attracted, because in the media it can sometimes seem like it's every other person, but what is the reality and what might that look like in a local church setting? Obviously it will vary place to place.
But. Yeah, no, see, I'm a words man, not a numbers man, so a number of numbers. I mean, so the percentage of population who are, I think it's LGBT, I think what the figures are for, among the whole population is something, I think around 1%, but do not quote me on that. But what I do know, what is really interesting, is once you narrow it down to kind of the 15 to 25 age bracket, at the moment is around 5%. That's the really significant thing actually to notice. Yeah. It's, in a sense, a really relatively uncommon experience among population broadly and among adults. But actually what we are seeing is this huge increase among teenagers and early 20s to the extent that it is now, I think the latest figures, I think we're in America actually, was around 5%. There are ONS figures in the UK as well. So, but that does mean, you know, if it is around 1%, which I think it is, that does mean if you've got a church of 100, you should expect there to be at least one person potentially who is sexually attracted or maybe is wrestling with their gender. So it's not huge numbers, but actually also we should expect our churches or desire our churches to reflect the population. So it is something I think all of us should be engaging with and wrestling with. And there are also surprising stats, again, I can't give you numbers, but I know they're there, of the proportion of LGBT people who do come from a religious kind of upbringing of some sense. That's the terms the research has used. Right. That could be quite broad. So actually, a disproportionate number of LGBT identifying people do in some way have some sort of religious background, often Christian. And that's interesting for us as well, actually. So we should expect there's lots of people who know something of the gospel or truth, and might have had some sort of church involvement, and might maybe want to come back, but we find it difficult to do. I think that's just also interesting and important for us to be aware of.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really helpful. And I certainly personally know two people, a number of people I've walked with who are same-sex attracted in the church. I know two of them have walked away. But another three or four are still very much in church, and clearly some people have found that a difficult place to be. Other people have found church a welcoming, a wonderful place to be. And I'm not sure, perhaps either from your experience and or from others that you've heard from, what can be some of the challenges of walking into a church, being same-sex attracted, being gay, and being welcomed and being part of that church? What are some of the challenges that you've come across?
I think one initial challenge, Jess, is for many people who experience same-sex attraction, coming into a church just feels inherently daunting. I think certainly historically, and I think it is mainly historically and not solely, Christians have badly treated same-sex attracted people, have totally misunderstood the experience, have sometimes actually outright rejected and stuff. And sadly, Christians weren't the first to speak up against the bad treatment of LGBT people as we should have been. And I think there understandably is, in a sense, a kind of an impact, a hangover from that. So there's just a sense of trepidation for a same-sex attracted person coming to a church of, are these people just going to be deeply homophobic? And are they just going to reject me, hate me? And I think that's a very rare experience actually to happen now in a UK church. Mm-hmm. But I think we mustn't overlook kind of the impact that has had on people's expectations of the fear, and also the fact that, you know, the media and certain campaigners, and particularly Christian campaigners who want the church to change its position away from biblical teaching, Christian orthodoxy, kind of send this message of churches that don't affirm gay relationships are inherently dangerous for same-sex attracted people. So a same-sex attracted person coming to church is coming with all of this kind of expectation and baggage in a sense. And even that is a huge thing. So in a sense, even coming to the doors can be daunting. I think there are still sadly rare cases, and they are rare. I think I've only heard of, you know, very rare occasional anecdotal stories of people who have been badly treated in churches, people who just either just been told they're not welcome, or just people are kind of almost, I guess it is kind of fearful of them. And often it is just kind of a people don't understand, people haven't thought it through. That's why conversations like this are so important. That's why talking to our churches about this topic is so important, because we want to create a welcome environment before people even get there, in a sense, necessarily. But then I guess there's just all manner of different things. Sometimes it's that church culture and what church is like can be quite uncomfortable for someone who's same-sex attracted. It's very easy for churches to kind of elevate marriage as the be-all and end-all, as being married and having kids as kind of a goal. As I said, that was kind of my what I imbued as a child. And again, I think a lot of us are getting better in our church than that, but there can still be a lot of that. The reality is the vast majority of churches, certainly the vast majority of church leaders, are married people with kids. And even that can be isolating. There's a sense of, that's not my life experience. Mm-hmm. Where do I kind of fit in here? I mean, I guess just one other is kind of people wrestling with, well, what does following Jesus look like for me? And what's kind of the cost of that? And actually, maybe someone's coming really uncertain of what the Bible says, uncertain even if they are a follower of Jesus or want to be, and they're wrestling with, how does that fit my sexuality? Mm-hmm. So for some people, the challenge of entering a church is just, there might be a real interest in exploring the claims of Jesus and an interest in faith, but a fear of, what does this mean for me? And I think actually where church can be unhelpful in that, in a sense, is if we saints aren't all counting the cost of following Jesus. Actually, if we as churches are fairly cost light in our gospel, and our gospel kind of is just forgiveness of sins and God will make your life wonderful. Yeah. But actually, for a subset of people, there's, oh, and also you've got to do this really difficult thing, actually sacrifice these desires and this stuff. That just feels really unfair and really difficult. And so actually often the fact we are not always great at preaching the full gospel, including repentance, the cost of following Jesus, that I think can make church a very difficult context for someone who's same-sex attracted, who does want to be faithful to biblical teaching.
That's really good, Andrew.
Yeah, that's a great point, isn't it? I think, that actually the challenge is, are we preaching the whole gospel to everybody? Because the guy that runs his local business, is he submitting all his tax? Actually for them that's a significant issue, and it's just the same, it's just as painful and just as difficult in some ways. If you haven't got a lot of money, you kind of think, oh, I'll just, and as you say, preaching the whole gospel's important. Can I ask a question? You travel a lot, obviously, you talked about how would you describe your the average church leader? Because I suppose my impression, I work with quite a lot of church leaders, and I would say that the biggest thing I would come across is just they're afraid of the issue, if I'm honest, right? And not because they're afraid, just in a sense of fearful, but almost afraid of saying the wrong thing, afraid of not unsure about how to tackle it. They're just, and I suppose that's, again, as part of this whole series, is trying to educate and just get the conversation going to remove the fear. Because I suppose not a lot of church leaders have got a lot of experience in dealing with people coming in from that background. And almost, I think, it's almost, they're uncertain about how they would even respond to that. Would you say that's fair or true, or what you've experienced?
I think so. I mean, in some sense, my anecdotal observation of church leaders will be skewed by, if they come to an event where I'm speaking, they've probably started from a certain position already. So there is that to say. But I do think my observation, in a sense, the real encouragement is the vast majority of church leaders I talk to and meet really want to love social minority as well, really want to welcome them to the church, really want to help them thrive and flourish following Jesus. But it is absolutely, there's a fear in the sense of a feeling ill-equipped, a nervousness of unintentionally hurting people or saying the wrong thing, whatever it might be. So I think I see a lot of, the heart is absolutely in the right place, but a sense of people feeling ill-equipped. Yeah. So in part, that's why something like Living Out, the organization I work for, exists. So we want to help equip churches. And we are very much an organization trying to equip churches to do the stuff in the local context rather than, you know, us doing the work. In a sense, we're about equipping people to be the kind of church families we're called to be, to be a good home for everyone. But also the thing I want to say to church leaders is, as much as I think there's a need for something like Living Out, also we have these kind of mental barriers about sexuality and gender particularly. We think of them as these very potentially mysterious and certainly kind of complex and you know, true controversial and emotive topics in their real life. But we so often as leaders kind of switch off all our leadership and pastoral common sense and all the good wisdom that we have from all the day-to-day leading and pastoring we do. And actually, I often would say to pastors, you are much more equipped to do all this than you think you are. Yeah. And in a sense, just, you know, take a deep breath. Don't be freaked out by the fact that this is an experience of gender or sexuality. Actually, remember, you are well equipped, and the Spirit of God is with you to equip you as well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, even for people, my encouragement to them is, you know, do a mental exercise and imagine that this situation wasn't actually about an experience of sexuality and gender, but with something else which might be kind of vaguely parallel. You'll probably find you'd feel pretty well equipped for that. So there's lots of skills and understanding and wisdom you can kind of transfer across. So I want to say the both end of, yes, there's a healthy sense of, as a leader, I want to learn, I want to understand, I want to get equipped, and I want to encourage people to do that. But also I want to say, you are also quite well equipped in lots of ways as well. And don't, in a sense, ignore all the resources you already have within yourself and from the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. No, that's really good, Andrew. I completely agree with you. And it's a very common question, actually, that I get speaking on this. I know it is for you as well. When people say, what do I do when somebody who's seems as attracted walks into the church? And so when that question comes to you, just what's your response? So what do I do when they arrive in the church?
That does tend to be when I say, well, have a think, you know, take sexuality out of the context. Imagine this is a couple of people in a different situation, what it might be, because pretty much anyone who comes to your church, probably Christian or not, is in some ways living out of faithfulness to Jesus. And so actually it's just a question of, what does it mean for us as leaders, as pastors, to help people step into faithfulness to Jesus? So what do we do? Say a gay couple come to the church, say they're maybe not Christians, but interested in faith. What do? Well, we make sure they feel really welcomed. We befriend them. We make sure they know that they're so welcome to be part of our community, just as any person who's not yet following part of Jesus is part of our community. And there might well be things within that which, in a sense, they're not able to partake in. Bread and wine, say, for many places would be a kind of a line in the sand there. But actually, we're not treating them differently because they're gay. They're like everyone else here who's not yet a follower of Jesus, because we're a community of Jesus followers, but we love having others come and be a part of us as well. Yeah. And then really it's trying to prioritize introducing them to Jesus. So yeah, the priority isn't sorting out their relationship or their sex life. The priority is introducing them to Jesus, sharing the good news of the gospel with them, inviting them to respond to him. Because in a sense, lifestyle change and living change is only going to come and is only purposeful, in a sense, if it's part of repentance and following Jesus. And so, to the extent of, I sometimes encourage people, you know, if someone comes to your church and says, I'm in a gay relationship, what do you think about that? I think one interesting approach to try is, well, it doesn't really matter what Jesus thinks about your relationship and your sexuality if you don't believe he is who he says he is, he didn't rise from the dead. So should we talk about Jesus? And if you decide to follow him, then definitely want to come back and talk about your sexuality, as all of us have lots of things to think through then. But it doesn't necessarily matter at the moment. And because one of the things we want to do is get people out of this mindset of God and Christians hate gay people and they're obsessed with the gay thing, and actually show, no, we're obsessed with Jesus and we want you to know Jesus, and Jesus wants to know you. And for all of us, Jesus coming to our life is a bit of the bombshell and changes everything. And so with you, as with anyone, we'll hope you work through that afterwards, but actually that's where we want to start. And so really, yes, we want to invite them to follow Jesus, and then it is helping them wrestle with that if they might decide to make that decision. And I think that's the language I'd use, helping people to wrestle with, what does the Bible say? What does this mean for me? Helping people to journey. Although there are, I think, clear biblical parameters, and there's a role for us in leading and pastoring to teach and to lay down those, actually for someone coming in that context, say, there's a big journey to go of processing this, of understanding biblical teaching, of wrestling with that, of the kind of heart battle to do that, the grief there'll be over the loss of relationships, stuff like that. And so actually to see ourselves as someone journeying or accompanying someone on a journey rather than as kind of, you know, a sergeant major giving the orders that they've got to obey is, I think, the healthy approach to do it, which does mean we have to be prepared for a bit more mess and a bit more grey areas, yeah. because sanctification takes time. My observation is in church circles like mine, which are quite charismatic, we think of sanctification as kind of, you know, pray, wham, bam, Holy Spirit, done. And yeah. that's just not the biblical picture. The biblical picture is putting on, walking out. It's all kind of growth. It's all this kind of ongoing stuff. Yeah. And I think we've got to prepare for the fact that sometimes this stuff's going to take time and we've got to be in it alongside people yeah. for the long run.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's an excellent book which I read a few years ago, which is, I'm sure you've read, which is called Change of Affection by Beckett Cook. Yeah, and I thought, just to reiterate the point you're making, I think the thing I took away from that book was that really people need an experience with Jesus. If you haven't met Jesus, why would you change your lifestyle? Yeah. Like the reason that you're choosing to live in the way you are and the reason that I'm choosing to be a church pastor and not, you know, be working and earning a lot more money doing other things is because of Jesus. And so until you've encountered Jesus, it's like you're trying to live without the why, isn't it? You're trying to live in the what and the how, but really if you haven't understood the why, it's pointless. And I think absolutely, like, you know, that is our job, is to introduce people to Jesus and worry. I suppose Jesus was a lot less concerned about their mess. He was concerned about their mess in a sense after they'd really encountered him rather than before. And I think sometimes we've almost, because I suppose the media, I guess, have made such a big deal of this particular issue, in a sense we're trying to almost worry about dealing with someone's kind of, essentially, as you say, not being right with God, if that's sense, or living faithfully for Jesus. I love that expression, by the way. you know, we're trying to deal with that first before they meet with Jesus. And it's like, you know, in a sense, as you say, just being a pastor and helping people meet with Jesus is basically the job, isn't it? And then what comes after that is as you say, a walk like anybody else. I mean, I've personally just that explanation found it very, very helpful.
Yeah.
And thank you.
Really, it's just getting the gospel that I read, isn't it? I don't think sexuality is the only place we do this. We preach the gospel pretty well. We intellectually get the gospel, and yet so often our pastoral practice or instinct is sort yourself out. At least the instinct in his hearts, and what we need to help people move away from the instinct is: if I get myself right, if I sort my life out, I can get close to Jesus, and He'll love me. Because the gospel is no, get close to Jesus and experience His love, and that will help you sort your life out. And there's something in the human heart that we, you know, it's too good to be true in a sense, but it is true. It says something in the human heart that pushes against that. And so one of the key roles of a leader and pastor is to keep reminding people the gospel sounds too good to be true, and yet it is true. And actually, even with all your mess and your muck and your sin, what Jesus most wants is not strive to get yourself sorted to come to Him. Yep. It's come to Him because He longs to help you get yourself sorted. And just getting that in the right order and time again, you know, it's what He says all our corporate worship and stuff should be reaffirming time and time again. Of come to Jesus, encounter Him, experience His loving acceptance. From that is going to flow then faithfulness to Him.
Yeah. I would say if you're listening or watching this, it's probably a good point to go back and just listen to that again, because it's really helpful, Andrew. I wonder if I could just change tack a little bit, because I want to ask you a little bit about identity and about intimacy. And because so many, particularly of our young people, are being told in our society that your identity comes from your sexual preferences. And they've been told basically, if you're, you know, you need to choose what you are. And that can go for gender as well as for your you know, your attraction to other people. And you need to choose that. And actually, there are particular wins, if you like, in our culture from identifying with certain groups. And so, in our again, as church leaders, we need to be thinking and recognizing that this is coming into our church, that your sexual identity, and this is ages old, isn't it? This is centuries old stuff, really. It's nothing really new. But your identity comes from your sexual preferences. And that defines who you are. And then of course from that as well, it says, well, actually sexual intimacy is the way of fulfilling living a fulfilled life, and that you can only live a fulfilled life if you're having sex, if you're in a sexual romantic relationship. And that is the worldview that people are bringing from, you know, culture into the church. And these are young people in our youth groups, this is those who are not in our youth groups, who are kind of getting that view of the world from popular culture. This is a big question then. How do we as leaders teach into that? How do we think about what Christian identity looks like? What does intimacy look like in the church? There you go, Andrew.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. Those are two key things. When I talk to youth leaders these days, I say after the gospel, the next things to talk about are identity and probably friendship, actually, in a sense, actually, I think that kind of think about intimacy and stuff. Yeah, identity, so... Well, part of it is recognizing the good in both of those things. And actually, what's going on in our culture is we're all asking, who am I? and we're all saying I have a need for intimacy, both of which are a good question to ask and a true thing, a God-given need. And so we want to affirm the goodness, but then we want to help people, including young people, think about actually, are we answering the question rightly? Are we thinking about intimacy rightly? And so we all understandably, rightfully ask the question, who am I? My observation is we forget to ask the prior question of how do I find who I am? And so we're all asking, who am I? We're all functionally living with an answer to that. You can't live without a sense of identity. You're all living with it in some way. We don't first ask, well, how do I find that? And so I have found it helpful to encourage people in a sense to bring into the light what we all do instinctively or kind of unmask what's going on and to think critically about that. And my observation is there are two ways that happens in the world around us, both of which some people would say one's old, one's new. I think both are happening simultaneously in many people. One is what I call an others decide identity, where your sense of self is built on what you assume other people think of you. And so if you think people look at you and evaluate you as a really successful person or a really intelligent person or an attractive person, that gives you a good sense of self. Of course, it can go really wrong. You can assume they think you're a freak or a failure or a weirdo or whatever. That can give you a really bad sense of self. And I think things like, you know, social media, all kind of different things are playing into that sense of we're assessing ourselves, what we assume other people think of us. And I would reckon one of the reasons for poor mental health among young people is in part that their sense of competition among each other and what people think of them. So there's that sense of identity. But also there's what I call I decide identity, which is what you particularly will mention, John. It's I look inside of myself and my feelings and my desires, and that's my true self. That's really me. And it's I decide because I look inside myself, I find my feelings and desires, only I can know who I am, and then I declare it to the world around me. And if that's who I am, then nothing outside matters. My body doesn't matter. What people say, my tradition, my religion, none of those things matters. What matters is that I embrace who I am. And if that's who I really am, then I'm going to find my best life by embracing that and expressing that. And that's the narrative in our culture. That's, you see that, you know, in kind of the, you know, inspirational slogans you see on Instagram, you know, don't change who you are for anyone else, those kind of things. You hear it in song lyrics, you see it in your films. The quintessential example is Princess Elsa from Frozen. You know, she has this internal thing, these magical powers, and she starts off by suppressing those, and that's really bad because that brings an eternal winter to Arendelle. We're telling young people who you really are is inside, and if you suppress that, that's really bad news. But the film goes on, she embraces those powers, she lets them out, summer comes, open doors at the palace. She's the hero because she's ignored what everyone else said to her, which is suppress who you really are inside, and she's embraced it, and everything works out really well. You know, Disney is the great philosopher of our day. Elsa is the great hero. And so Let It Go, the reason that song, one of the reasons that song was such a phenomenon is it perfectly encapsulates what our society believes about identity. Yeah. Let it go, let it out. She's letting out this swirling storm she finds inside. Yeah. She's no longer being the good girl that other people want her to be. She's embracing who she really is. That's what our young people are being told. And we need to just help them think, though, does that work? Is that true? Because there are some really big problems with that. One problem is incredible pressure. And we're seeing this among young people. If only you can know who you are, because it's all based on what you find inside, that's incredible pressure. Young people are being told, you must find out who you are, and only you can do that. And you need that to live your best life. What pressure as a teenager. I'm going to miss out my best life if I can't work out from this. You know, all of us have a mess of stuff inside, particularly as teenagers. What on earth or who on earth am I? And the reality is those desires often aren't clear. They change. Often we don't know what we're thinking through, frankly. So there's huge pressure. But also the real problem with this and the real clincher is none of us really believe it. And so we all know there are some feelings, desires we might look inside and find. And none of us would say, yes, that's who you are, you do you, you be yourself, even sexual desires. Okay. So it's just helping young people see this really isn't a good way of making identity, but there is a much better answer to the question, how do I find who I am? And that's God decides. And it's an answer that makes sense. If we're made by God, it kind of makes sense we'd receive our identity from him. So actually, what does he say about us? And it's helping young people see actually we're invited to receive an identity, not that we achieve by getting people to think of us in a certain way, not that we discover within, but we receive as a gift. It's an identity based on what Christ has done. Therefore, it's not going to change. Your feelings and desires, they might change. People's opinions, they might change. It's all based on what Jesus has done. And actually, you can receive this identity of being a child of God who is loved, who he sings songs over, he delights over, that can never change. It's all based on what Jesus has done. And that gives you a solid sense of self from which then to kind of take hold of your feelings, your desires, and to assess them, not to be controlled by them. And so you don't suppress them and ignore them to make people think well of you. And you don't indiscriminately embrace them but actually you get to go, okay, so I'm experiencing this desire. What do I do with that? I feel like it's going to make me really happy, but actually what does the Bible say about it? It kind of just frees us from captivity to desires to be able to healthily look at them and assess them. So with identity, I think just finding any way we can time and time again to affirm to young people that who they really are is who God says they are, not just what they feel inside. Yeah. And just briefly on the intimacy thing, I think you're right, that's so key as well. Yeah. The problem in our culture is we have equated love or sex and intimacy. And so we live in a culture that cannot kind of conceive of intimacy intimacy without sex, which is why things like bromances work. You know, who is it? Louis Tomlinson and Harry Styles from One Direction. They're seen as a bromance because they're such good mates that the fans kind of look on and say they can't just be friends. And so there's all these kind of ideas. Well, obviously, there's more going on because we see genuine love, especially between men in our culture, and we assume sex. Yeah. But actually, that's just not true because we all know something like family. When family's working rightly, it's genuine love, but without sex. We all know love can exist, intimacy can exist without sex. Yeah. And so it's kind of helping people to sever that and realize actually your need for love is totally right and God-given and legitimate, but you don't need to be having sex for that. Yeah. And for me, actually, that was the breakthrough. Those years when I was wrestling with, can I do this? How to live this out? My breakthrough moment really was realizing what I felt like I really wanted was to have a man I could sleep with. But when I realized actually what that was about was I wanted to love and to be loved. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, okay, God might be saying I can't sleep with a man, but he's not saying I can't love and be loved. Actually, that's the bit I actually need. And experiencing love in friendship in a church family was what suddenly made me realize, oh, this is plausible. God's not denying me anything that I need. Singleness can work because there is intimacy even without sex, even without marriage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brilliant.
It is brilliant. Yeah. And I thanks for that explanation. It takes me back to your story really, Andrew, right at the beginning, you were talking about how you were walking with somebody and you just in the context, it sounds like to me in the context of a friendship of where you were doing life together, where you talk about other things that you felt able to share something which was actually very, obviously very personal, something you've been grappling with. And I must say the number of friends of mine who have got some similarities to that, where they said this is not just something, they don't just walk into the church and announce, hi everybody, you know, I'm gay, how are you? It's something that comes through and is talked about in the context of genuine friendships. And so I guess sort of thinking as we think about, you know, church leaders and what this looks like in a church to love people well, who have these pressures. And as we said, you know, the cost should be similar for them, but there are costs in our society of seeking to live as a celibate, you know, lifestyle as a gay person because of the sheer pressure and the criticism you get from secular people who think it's harmful that you would, you know, deny yourself all these things. How are we places which that love people well, that walk in friendship and intimacy that looks like that?
Yeah, it's so key. How do we be the church community that does make this plausible and help people walk a difficult path? Various things, some of which you touched on, I guess, already. Part of it is having a culture where everyone's counting the cost of following Jesus. I think it's just, difficult things always so much easier, aren't they, when you know you're not alone in the sense, actually. That's not why we count the cost, but we should be a community of people, counting the cost, walking a difficult road of following Jesus as part of that. It is, I think, the thing of getting friendship right and getting church family right is really key. I do think because it's such a human thing to want to love and be loved, and a God-given need, and that's there in Genesis 2. That is so often the issue for people, really, actually. And so often either identity, how could God ask me to know who I am, or intimacy, how can God deny me intimacy, really is the reasons people give up on biblical teaching. And so addressing both of those is key. So I think it is being a church which really does value friendship. But, you know, my encouragements to leaders will always be to really think about and look into what does the Bible say about friendship. We think a lot and talk a lot and teach a lot probably our churches what the Bible says about marriage and very little about friendship. When in reality, marriage biblically is the optional relationship, you know. 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's really clear, frankly, that singleness is better and why not consider staying single? Whereas John 15, Jesus, I think, shows friendship as a marker of faithfulness to him. John 15, Jesus talks about friendship as this greatest example of love, greater love as no man this, that he laid out his life for his friends. And then he talks about abiding in him, He says, the proof of abiding in Jesus is keeping his commands. Well, the only command in John 15 is the command to love one another as he has loved us. So Jesus is saying, if you want to, you know, demonstrate the proof that you are abiding in me, you're a follower of me, is that you keep my command to love one another as I have loved you, i.e. deep love. And he's just defined friendship as a relationship of love. It seems to me that John 15 says that actually having deep, meaningful, loving, self-sacrificial friendship is a marker of being a follower of Jesus. That's the seriousness, in a sense, with which the Bible approaches friendship. So it's casting a vision for that, literally just talking about it, raising the bar on that. I mean, you know, interesting question, how many sermons have you heard on friendship? Probably not very many. How many heard on marriage? Probably quite a lot. That's just interesting.
You know, it's a fascinating point, isn't it? It's interesting.
But yeah, I think we talk about it, and also we want to exemplify it. So we want to, particularly as leaders, again, lead by example. If you're a church leader and people think of you as a good family man with his wife and his kids, but they don't think of you as a good friend, and they're not aware that you give time and effort into developing friendships and loving your friends and having deep, meaningful friendships, and you're sharing life with people. If you as a leader are not doing that, why would anyone in your church do it? In a sense, we show friendship is important by showing that in our lives. I think that overlaps with the church family thing. I think, what does it mean for church to be family? Partly it means that getting friendship right. But particularly, I think church family means doing the things of ordinary life, but doing them together, because that's most of family life, isn't it? Family life isn't all the big special occasions, you know, candelabras and best silver and stuff and three-course dinner. It's just having pizza in front of Britain's Got Talent or whatever it is. It's doing the really normal mundane things, but doing it with other people. Yeah. And I think, so in my experiences, those kind of experiences are much more life-giving than, yeah, being treated like a special guest, say. So how do we just open our homes, open our families, open our weekly diaries and routines, in a sense, to do more of life together, so everyone gets to experience a sense of family, which brings with it a sense of intimacy.
Yeah, that's great.
I think that whole idea, isn't it, of community and friendship, I think is something that our society is really challenged, is finding very difficult. I've got three kids, and you know, by the time that you're just maintaining your own family life, you know, it's really difficult to make space for other people, in a sense. It is difficult, and it's just tiresome. People are, you know, we're so busy. And I think actually that is, as you say, a huge challenge. We're going to talk in another one of these podcasts, we're talking about singleness. It's the same principle. You know, we as you say, how many examples I've been trying to do in my preaching is, when you give examples, how many of your examples relate to being married? How many of them relate to what it's like to be single? You know what I mean? And I think it's just something that you know, I've become increasingly aware. We've got a number of friends that, you know, are single, and it's a real, as you say, it's a real challenge to think about what friendship looks like. And it's definitely, I think leaders need help in that, actually, because I think leaders often, I don't know if you've noticed this. I know that John and I have talked about this. I don't know if we talked about it on this podcast, but before, leaders struggle with friendships. Mm-hmm. They just do. They really do. And often the reason that leaders burn out, if you dig into it, one of the biggest issues that causes moral failure in leadership, you know, exhaustion, burnout in leadership, is a lack of friendship. And so I just think what you're highlighting there is just a huge issue, really. That, as you say, they're almost like underpinning issues, aren't they? You know, like, you know, we jump immediately to this kind of the hot button issues, but actually some of the other issues are like friendship. You know, teaching on intimacy and what sex is, those things are actually deeper, but in a sense provide the culture and the foundation for the rest of this kind of conversation and healthy kind of culture to build, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think actually if you are a church leader or youth leader, the same thing, if you want to engage well with the topics and experience of sexuality, you do want to occasionally talk about them, but you can do almost all of it, and it's better to almost all of it by not talking about it at all, but talking about identity, about intimacy, friendship, church family, the cost of following Jesus. You know, you almost need to barely ever talk in sexuality. And particularly, I think that's helpful for youth leaders. Some youth leaders just feel, actually, we've never talked about this. All the young people believe all this kind of secular stuff in a sense already. It's just not going to work if we come in with the sex talk or what the Bible says. Yeah. That might well be true, but you can do almost all of it well before talking about sexuality. Start talking about identity, start talking about friendship, all that kind of stuff. You're preparing the ground. So then when you bring in a Christian view of sexuality, it doesn't seem so radical and wild because it joins all the dots, in a sense, of everything else you've already been talking about.
Yeah, that's good. I think we're probably pretty much out of time, actually. I just want, just a reminder for those listening and watching, that, you know, there's two things to say. One is that this area, like culturally, it can be a very challenging area. You know, we've got the gay conversion therapy ban sort of moving their way through parliaments and committees and so on. There's lots going on there, and it can be very easy to feel threatened, you know, and that we might be going to prison or something like that. And I think on the one hand, we need to be aware that, you know, it's going to be increasingly costly to hold a biblical sexual ethic for church leaders, as well as those who are same-sex attracted. But on the other hand, I think from what you just said, all the way through, really, Andrew, what a tremendous opportunity, both in terms of biblical teaching to address these key issues, but also just as a church community to be those places of friendship and intimacy and welcome and genuine family that people are longing for, that actually the local church should be and can be the place where we find that. And actually in a diverse setting of families, of children, of, you know, of every sort of sense of diversity, this could be a wonderful place for people to find the Lord and to grow in the knowledge of the Lord Jesus. So I think for me, that's the sense I get from our conversation, is that, yeah, this is challenging and there's some work for us to do, but actually equally, what a great opportunity to live out the gospel. And I feel excited as in sort of someone in leadership, and I hope that, you know, those listening to feel the same, that there's a sense of excitement and opportunity to love people well. So, and there's some great resources from Andrew and the team at Living Out. There's a brilliant church audit, which we'll put the link in the show notes, but you just see there on the screen, livingout.org. But there's a great church audit, which is really sort of asking you some really incisive questions about how you're getting on as a church. We'd recommend you do that. I mentioned Andrew's book. He's actually got another book that's coming out as this is being released, really. It's called Finding Your Best Identity, A Short Christian Introduction to Identity, Sexuality, and Gender. So, yeah, do check that out, where Andrew unpacks, I think you do anyway, Andrew, you unpack all of these things and get into things a little bit more. So, yeah, Andrew, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, pleasure. Enjoy.
Yeah, we've really appreciated you being with us. And so, yeah, so that's in our episode, looking at diversity in the church, focusing on sexuality. It's part of our series on diversity in the church, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Bye from all of us here today.